Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. I'm Nick Dubois, the appellant pro se. Let me thank the court for the opportunity to be heard in person on a case which now is primarily New Jersey state law, following the settlement with three of the parties, counting the FDIC, corporate, and receiver as two parties, and the lender's former counsel. I'm asking this court to vacate the judgment of dismissal with prejudice of the district court with leave to replead and drop claims that are no longer viable in light of the settlement. I'll attempt to be brief. The heart of the district court's decision revolves around the conclusion, and remember, this is on the dismissal on the pleadings. There was no record, there was no oral argument or opportunity to clarify below. The court found—
That's true, of course, but you have the advantage for a judgment on the pleadings that everything you say is accepted as true, and everything that can reasonably be inferred from what you say.
Absolutely.
So, and the absence of evidentiary finding is, in a way, is potentially in your favor.
It should have been, Your Honor. And what I believe happened here is that the court misconstrued the facts. It found that the latest accrual date was January of 2006. Looking at—
You allege a date later than that in your complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. In the—
What paragraph?
It would be in the 90s. The court focused on 91 and 92, which recites the fact that lender's counsel, actually their second counsel, was substituted out. FM LLC refers to the former appellee, Finestein and Malloy LLC, which is a New Jersey law firm which had represented the lenders and Fannie Mae.
I got lost on that answer. Where is there a later date alleged here?
My error in paragraphs 93 to about 103, discussing
date given in 93 is December of 2005, right?
December of 2005.
Yes,
we'd heard from the successor firm. When I say we, my New Jersey counsel had heard from the successor firm that they would be substituting in. In January of 2006, we got a confirmatory letter from the withdrawing firm of the substitution and began dealing with the lender's third counsel, this which is referred to as the Norris firm. So in a nutshell, in an effort to be brief within the time frame here, what happened at that juncture was the substitution of attorney. I am at a loss. I continue to be at a loss why that put me on discovery notice of fraud. To Your Honor's point, the inference to which I'm entitled is that when the lenders brought in a more senior, more sophisticated, larger law firm, and we began discussing mitigation and so on and so forth and talking about contract, the inference is that I was not on notice of fraud. I had good reason to believe, my attorney had good reason to believe, that the lenders were acting in good faith and trying to rectify an error. I mean, after all,
Where have you alleged misconduct after January 2006 in the complaint? Is there a place that we can go to and you say an actionable action took place after January 2006 that is the basis for my claim? That's all I'm looking for.
Yes. The question is, when did we realize there's—
The question is, where in your complaint have you said actionable action took place after January 2006?
That would be paragraph 95. There was communication with counsel.
Okay, paragraph 95.
That's 845.
March of 2006, right?
It was 843. There were also in the complaint, there was failures to issue.
I mean, let's just stick with 95. I mean, if 95 is taken as it's written, you regarded it as confirming all kinds of bad behavior by WaMu and Fannie Mae, right?
Yes, we were trying to get them to.
So what is there after that?
Well, after that was they never provided an accounting, which they were obligated to do.
You haven't alleged anything occurring after 2006, have you, that constitutes either actionable conduct or a point at which notice was greater than it was already by 2006?
Failure to issue a mortgage 1098s for any year thereafter. On a monthly basis, accruing interest and fees to which they were not entitled. I'm focusing on the discovery,
What is the fraud you're claiming occurred in this period after January or March 2006?
The fraud. I'm going to attempt.
I don't understand why interest accruing. Is fraud. It might maybe fraud that is leads to interest accruing, but the interest accruing doesn't sound like fraud.
Fees to which they were not entitled.
What's the best allegation of that would make most clear to us what you're talking about in your complaint? Of what you just said?
Well, for example, in paragraph 102, which is at A45, at the time...
Tax collector.
Yes, at the time the lenders were saying that it was all an escrow problem and that they were correct. So in an effort to mitigate damages, at this point we're handling this as a contract claim. They're saying, well, all right, in New Jersey, the town will not actually accept taxes directly from a borrower. It has to come from the bank unless the bank releases it. And we asked for that. They wouldn't do that. That's looking, you know, with 2020 hindsight, that opened the door for the lenders to continue misusing the escrow account to assess fees.
I mean, whatever the significance of these events. There's no date.
Yeah.
Your Honor, when my counsel realized what was going on.
This allegation has no date in it, right?
It did not, no. It follows, I tried to tell under Twombly, it was my first and only effort post-Twombly to give sufficient facts. But even Twombly says that there is a let me give the court the exact, not requiring a heightened pleading of specifics. I told the story. Actually, this is the edited version.
Yeah, so we're at this point where we're considering a statute of limitations. Twombly did not deal with a statute of limitations.
No, it dealt with specificity. What I had done is I'd edited out.
Right, it dealt with specificity. It did not deal with statute of limitations.
It did not.
Yes.
I'm addressing the pleading. Here is the error. Here is what the whole thing turns on. The fraud became patent and undeniable. The lender's misconduct, let's say, in 2007. We worked with my distinguished adversary's predecessor firm. My attorney, through 2007.
Are you alluding to the passage in your reply brief saying that you received a look that told volumes, spoke volumes? That was not helpful to me. And this is page 5. We got a talk.
That has
not illuminated anything for me.
The allegation of the complaint is that the essence and the inference to which I'm entitled is that beginning in January of 2006, when distinguished and respected law firm came in, that there was not a fraud, that it was, and I don't think they believed that there was a fraud at the time, that I was lulled into thinking this is bureaucratic bungling, we will fix the accounting errors, escrow account errors, and so on and so forth. And then they wouldn't respond. They wouldn't respond for a while. And when you're dealing with big bureaucracies in Fannie Mae, you don't expect to hear from them the next day. This is before the mortgage crisis. This, as we all know, was before banks started setting up departments to help lenders. The robo-signing was not in the lexicon at this time. Was I on, I mean, there was something funny going on, but was I on absolute notice that there was a fraud? No. When the Norris firm stopped answering, I ran into one of their attorneys who gave me this look, we got to talk. That's the date. That was in 2007, and quite frankly, I did not plead it.
Is that in your complaint? Where is that in your complaint?
The date 2007, yeah. It is not in my complaint, but
that's
I did call
that's
it.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it should not have been a problem. I should have, look, with 2020 hindsight, I should have put that date in there. I was not expecting the foreshortened statute of limitations and a compulsory jurisdiction. I do not believe that that was the intent of Congress by requiring that the case be brought either here, where the FDIC is situate.
Do we not review legislation with the presumption that Congress knows the law?
It did not speak to the statute of limitations.
Do we not review legislation with the assumption that Congress knows the law? How can we construe that statute with an assumption that Congress did not know that D.C.'s choice of law was law of form?
Because the alternative, Your Honor.
The alternative would have been a law of the place in which.
Either Washington or Nevada, it's not clear. So the question
aren't
is.
Aren't you asking us to assume that Congress did not know this would be the D.C. construction?
I think it's fair to say this is a case that Congress never anticipated. I think this is probably unusual where supplemental jurisdiction is being exercised over claims from a jurisdiction with double the statute of limitations. This is not a diversity case. This is not a case that could have been brought in the
which case Congress said had to be brought here, right?
Here or where the bank was situated.
Right.
So what would be the alternative? What did Congress intend then? Piecemeal litigation, which I believe is what the adversary is arguing for. I would also point out another thing. Well, to bring the state cases in New Jersey and to bring the FDIC in here and then to remove and ask the plaintiff asking to transfer to a foreign jurisdiction. There was no clean way to bring all of the claims under mandatory joinder. I would point out also that New Jersey's statute of limitations is undisputed, is substantive, and I believe substantive law of another state applies. And finally, there is some authority. It's in the federal procedure, the lawyer's edition at section 2607, that says if Congress didn't specifically speak to the statute of limitations in the federal statute, quote, it is the duty of the federal courts to assume that the importation of state law will not frustrate or interfere with the national policy. I do not believe that Congress intended to shorten, or for that matter, depending on the luck of the draw, lengthen the statute of limitations and thereby extinguish claims.
Well, why should we construe Congress as doing anything other than acting with knowledge of what the law would be? I'm not understanding. I keep hearing you say you don't believe Congress meant to do that. I have no basis to think you know any more about what Congress meant than anybody else does.
I could not find the congressional history on this.
Right.
I'm relying on.
Look at it if you did.
I think the intent is obvious that they wanted to convenience the agency. The error here was not allowing an amendment simply to say the discovery was in 2007 when no response.
Okay, unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the appellee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, David Panzer on behalf of the Chase defendants and speaking on behalf of all the appellees. I'd like to begin by addressing your questions as to the what the complaint says with respect to an accrual date. I think, as Your Honors have noticed, there was no date listed in the complaint after March of 2006 at all. But more than that, the real question is, when did the claims accrue? And under the plain law of the D.C. In Washington, D.C., D.C. Court of Appeals, the Mullen decision, an action accrues when the injury is readily identifiable. The action accrues on the date of the injury. And if you look at either the allegations of the complaint or even the way Mr. Dubois characterized the complaint to the district court in opposition to the motion to dismiss, and I'd ask Your Honors to look at the extract at page 62, he focuses not on these continuing torts or continuing things in 2007 and thereafter. He was talking about a fraud. And if you look back at the specific allegations of the complaint, he's talking about, first, there was a dispute that was resolved back in August of 2004 with a stipulated order of the federal court for the District of New Jersey. Thereafter, in paragraph 62 of the complaint, he alleged failures by WAMU and Fannie in March and April of 2005. He alleged breaches in June of 2006 in paragraph 67 to 70. He talks about his counsel raising issues as to these breaches in August of 2005.
Does your statute of limitations argument bar all of his claims, or are there some left standing?
There was nothing left standing. It was a complete bar. And I don't think there's any dispute as to that.
Okay.
The only question is the accrual date. Without going through everything in the complaint, if you look at paragraph 81, Mr. Dubois explains that he was aware of a ruse that the bank allegedly was trying to engage in. He was contending that there was an agreement reached with the federal district court, and he had to make certain payments, and the bank...
Where are we?
Sure. If you look at paragraph 81 of the complaint, he talks about there was a ruse, and he did not rely upon this attempted fraud, and he returned checks to the bank. That's extract page 40, complaint paragraph 81. And what he's just described is that he had made some payments. He says he made them on time. The bank's counsel returned the checks and attempted to get a set of post-dated checks to trick him into a default. And essentially, he caught them. And then in paragraph 88, A1, he says his counsel vehemently objected to what was going on and made a final demand. And thereafter, he explains in paragraph 90, that he declined to make further payments. That is, the plaintiff hasn't made a payment on his mortgage since November of 2005. And he, at that point, as of November 2005, he no longer had an obligation to perform. So to answer your question, Judge Williams, about when is the fraud, as of November 2005, 4 years before he actually filed the complaint, Mr. Dubois knew everything there was about the fraud that he had alleged. And if you turn to page 62 of the record extract, you get a one-paragraph summary by Mr. Dubois of what this case is about. And he says, in a nutshell, defendants and F&M acted in concert to fraudulently induce plaintiff into a settlement and modification in order to avoid the dire consequences of their conceded failure to comply with lawful discovery. And he goes on through that paragraph and explains plaintiff's former counsel rebuffed and returned these instruments, these checks, the lenders to the lenders through F&M, highlighting the criticality of the dates, whereupon F&M redeposited at least one date-critical instrument, an act of spoliation and contravention of the litigation hold. The other instruments had never been accounted for, nor the funds applied, constituting conversion. That's the nut of the case. Now, he does go on in the next sentence, and he does say in his opposition to the motion to dismiss that new counsel continued assurances of rectification through at least 2007. That 2007 date does not, again, appear in the complaint. But the nut of the case, as he puts it, was all known to him, and he alleges was known to him, by November of 2005. So although the district court pointed out liberally that there's no date beyond January of 2006 involving these defendants, clearly the date of accrual was much before then, Your Honor. The two issues that I'd like to focus on are the statute of limitations in general and then the proper construction of the P&A agreement as between the FDIC and J.P. Morgan.
If you win on the statute of limitations, does the P&A agreement have any bearing, any net need for you anyway?
There's no need, Your Honor. Technically, the district court's decision with respect to J.P. Morgan was based on the P&A agreement, although the analysis of the statute of limitations as to Chase Home Finance or Mr. Norton or the other appellees, it would all be exactly the same as to J.P. Morgan. So I don't believe this court actually has to reach the issue of the P&A agreement. The central flaw in Mr. Dubois' analysis of the statute of limitations is on page 9 of his brief, where he says, in a non-diversity matter, the substantive law of New Jersey with its 6-year statute of limitation applies. He's wrong. He relies upon this court's decision, as did the district court, in AI Trade Finance versus Petra, decided by this court in 1995. And as the court pointed out then, when you're dealing with a diversity matter, the law of the forum applies. The court goes on and explains at page 14.63 that the same law applies when you're dealing with supplemental jurisdiction. That's really Hornbook law. And because we were dealing with supplemental jurisdiction, we apply the law of the forum both as to choice of law and statute of limitations. And I think Mr. Dubois agrees that under D.C. choice of law, D.C. would apply its own statute of limitations, and there's no doubt that all the applicable D.C. statutes of limitation are 3 years. There's really not much more to say about a statute of limitations. There have been arguments raised really for the first time on appeal as to both fraudulent concealment and continuing conduct. Neither of those issues were in the complaint. Neither of those issues were really raised in opposition to the motion to dismiss. And if you look at the allegations of the complaint themselves, they certainly defeat fraudulent concealment. As I pointed out, Mr. Dubois has alleged that he was aware of this ruse and that he didn't fall for it back in November of 2005. I don't recall.
Incidentally, I mean, for the reasons we've just talked about, I think it's not of any consequence. But why would the P&A agreement bar the plaintiff?
Sure. So with respect to the P&A agreement,
I'm putting aside the question of whether the language purports to do it. But I'm just wondering why it would anyway.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure. I understand the question. Absent the whole analysis of the P&A agreement is the language in paragraphs 2.1 and 2.5. Are you asking me?
Yeah, but if one firm acquires another, does the agreement of acquisition completely dispose of the question of what claims carry forward to the acquiring firm?
The answer is yes, Your Honor. Under 12 U.S.C. 1821, the FDIC, when it comes and takes over a failed bank, has the ability it steps into the shoes of the bank, and it can break up the bank however it likes. It can sell the bank or it can sell specific assets of the bank. And that's what it did here. So in the midst of the financial crisis, J.P. Morgan was helping out the country to assist with the failing of WaMu. And what the assumption agreement did.
Who does the borrower have a claim against after this?
So, to the extent there were claims brought against J.P. Morgan, they were only brought against J.P. Morgan because it acquired certain assets of WaMu. Right. If there were claims that would have been against WaMu but for the failure, right, those are the claims that are brought against the FDIC as receiver for WaMu. And so that was the administrative process that Mr. Dubois...
They would be FDIC receiver claims.
That's correct.
Claims against receiver, rather.
Okay, and
correct.
I'm just curious about the whole thing. So the supply of assets that the plaintiff can go against in that form is simply whatever happens to be left over to WAMU after the best assets have been acquired by another firm.
Your Honor, I'll confess I'm not sure specifically what assets are available. I do know that there's an entire administrative process that's available to the FDI receiver, and then if...
At least in some instances, they would have received valuable consideration in return for the assets they sold. I realize in some it's almost a wash, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
And I don't know which it was in this case.
I don't know. So that's practically, I mean, the question is really, once WAMU failed, which is the party that's
right.
responsible for the claim? Here, it's okay. The FDIC as receiver. It's not J.P. Morgan.
There's an explicit statute that governs the effect of this.
Correct, Your Honor. And so
the...
And it's really the inducement, right? You're asking another bank to come in and purchase certain assets of a failed bank, and obviously, whether it's Chase Home Finance operating as a servicer moving forward would be liable for its own conduct. But really, what Mr. Dubois is asking the court to do is to hold J.P. Morgan as a purchaser of certain assets liable for conduct that WAMU engaged in that it didn't know about and that Mr. Dubois had not yet brought a lawsuit about. And those are claims that were specifically not assumed.
Okay. Unless my colleagues have further questions, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Do you wish rebuttal? Do you wish rebuttal? Do you want to rebut? Okay, 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Counsel relies, I believe, on a misreading of the P&A agreement, which it argued below should be strictly construed. This loan was not made by WAMU. It is also independent.
What only reaches that if the statute of limitations argument is inadequate?
Yes, Your Honor. And the law of this circuit is that, this was not addressed before, that a pro se should have the opportunity to amend. Everything counts.
To extend to a pro se who is, in fact, an attorney.
In Roshan versus Attorney General of the United States, 734 Federal Supplement 543, the district court in 1990 said, that's not the policy here, especially in this district where you have so many law school graduates. Doesn't mean, you know, a contract
they
patent attorney.
To practice law.
What it says is just because you graduate a law school doesn't mean that you can draft a competent federal complaint. I'm a patent attorney. I get to court now, and I'm obviously influenced by New Jersey practice, and I don't think this result would have occurred there. My one point, thank you for this opportunity over time. My one point is, yes, those dates are when the operative events occurred. In January of 2006, the lender started convincingly convincing my attorney that there was no fraud. That the return of checks, this is all a mistake, escrow, accounting, big bureaucracies. Under New Jersey law, it is very well settled, Justin versus People Bank. You cannot state that your victim should have been more astute. We both, my attorney and I both realized when his predecessor just wouldn't touch them anymore, oh my God, there is fraud. Why else wouldn't they touch this? That was 2007. I should, and I ask this court to allow me to amend, to put that date in. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Give us recess.
Thank you. Yes, that's right. It doesn't matter. We'll be back on Tuesday morning.